Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to begin our program today by taking a look at sustainable capitalism. John Eichert is our guest with us by phone today. John's a professor emeritus of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri, Columbia, and is the author of the book Sustainable Capitalism, A Matter of Common Sense. It's published by Camarion Press. He's written several other books, including A Return to Common Sense, Small Farms Are Real Farms, and Crisis and Opportunity, Sustainability in American Agriculture. So we're pleased to have him with us today. And as you listen to Professor Eichert speak, I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. John Eichert, as I mentioned, with us by phone. Professor Eichert, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having the opportunity to visit with your listeners today.
I appreciate it very much. Well, you, from what I understand, you feel that today's capitalism, capitalist economy is unsustainable. Why do you think that?
Well, I think we need to start with a recognition that, all economic value, anything that's useful to us and has value to us, either comes from nature or it comes from society. We can think about all of the kind of amazing technologies we've had, and we talk about innovation and creativity and how much we're able to create there. But if you think about all those technologies today without one of the resources of the earth, without fossil energy, I think you can begin to see how dependent we are still on the things from nature, the things from the earth. And, of course, our food comes from the earth. It comes from the earth. It comes from the people that grow the food on the earth. And without that, the resources of the earth, we wouldn't have food. We wouldn't have anything that relates to fossil energy. And the other source is society, because it's society that creates the people that have the ability to create the technologies that allow us to turn fossil energy into something useful and allow us to grow crops to produce food. And we aren't born as productive individuals. We're born as helpless little babies, and we have to be nurtured and civilized and socialized and educated, and that's done by society. So we, in fact, are a product of the society that we're in, and all economic value either comes from nature or society. And my contention is that over the last half century or so, at least, that we've been rapidly depleting the productivity of both nature and society, and if we continue to do that, we simply can't sustain the economy over the long run.
So we need to build a society that recognizes the maybe unique human and natural characteristics of our communities?
Yes, we need to kind of recognize the interconnectedness of everything, basically, on Earth. You know, we're made of those same elements from the Earth, the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, things of that nature. We're made from that. And we're interconnected with other people within society. And we need to recognize the inherent interconnectedness among us, between us and the Earth, and us and the rest of humans. Now, all the economy does is it simply facilitates those relationships. All the economy does today, rather than going out and producing our own food or making our own things from the earth, then we deal through the economy. We sell our labor, we sell our time, and we buy things. And rather than trading directly with other people, we work for other people, and then we hire other people to work for us. But all the economy does is kind of facilitate those physical and social relationships that are inherent within society. And so the economy itself can't produce anything.
Stephen Rice Lake has a question or comment for you, and I want to get him on right now. Steve, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. It's probably too early in the conversation to ask this question, but it occurred to me immediately. Until our recent charity to the bigger bankers, what industry in the United States has received more subsidies than the agriculture industry? And I would imagine, though I'm no expert, that this is also true of the other advanced industrial economies, that all of them provide vast subsidies to the agricultural system. And given that, I guess I need a clarification of what he means by capitalism.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I would agree. You know, nations historically have subsidized their agriculture in one time or another out of a recognition of their dependence upon agriculture and upon food for the survival of people. But I think we've become distracted, particularly in this country and other countries of the world, in terms of mistaking kind of short-run productivity or simply the ability to produce a lot with food security or with the security of the nation. So I would argue that for the last several decades, we've been subsidizing a kind of agriculture in this country that's extractive and exploiting. It's extracting the resources of the earth. It's depleting the productivity of the soil. And many things that are done, and I'm not talking about all farmers, but agriculture in general, it's polluting the water and the air with odors and agricultural chemicals and things of that nature. It's an agriculture that's very efficient in using up the natural productivity of the land and the fossil energy resources that it's relying on, and in a real sense, using up the productivity of the people. It's transforming agriculture from a thinking, creative, innovative occupation where people know how to work with nature in a regenerative, renewing way that's absolutely essential for sustainability, and it's turning it into kind of a mechanistic process where many people, you know, they're operating the machines and they're basically farming by recipe, but it's not an understanding of how to work with nature to sustain the productivity of nature over the long run. So I think the intent is there in terms of looking to agriculture as a source of food security, which is the long-run security of the nation, is important. But what we're doing now and what we've been doing for several decades is simply misdirected. We're in fact, subsidizing the exploitation of nature and the exploitation of people and helping to create this unsustainable society and unsustainable economy.
But how do we turn that approach around? How do we have a sustainable capitalism, a sustainable agriculture?
Well, I think it requires a change in thinking. For the last 200 years, we've been driven by kind of the industrial paradigm of development, specialization, standardization, consolidation of control. It's a very efficient means, that industrial model of using things up. And at the time we began this process, it appeared as if the resources of nature were unlimited. We would never run out. And it appeared that we couldn't do anything to society that it couldn't endure, that it was resilient. And now we know that that's not true. We know that we're depleting the natural resources and we're degrading human resources as well. And so it takes a change of thinking from that kind of industrial model to a model that's based more on the principles of living systems. You see, we have to have, to have sustainability, we have to regenerate and renew the resources at least as fast as we use them up. Living things are capable of doing that. You know, everything ultimately comes from energy. All the usefulness and sustainability is ultimately about that. We can use energy over and over again. We never use it up. But the second law of thermodynamics says that every time we reuse energy, some of the usefulness is lost. And that brings us around to the concept of sustainability being ultimately about using solar energy to renew and regenerate the resources of the earth, which in turn are necessary to renew and regenerate the resources of society. So it's this change in thinking from extraction and exploitation to regeneration and renewal. And once we can get that change in our mind, then we can begin to develop systems of farming and systems of manufacturing and systems of economics and systems within society as a whole that are based on that renewative, regenerative principle. One way of thinking about sustainable capitalism is that all economic capital either comes from natural capital, from the earth, or social capital, from society. And to have a sustainable capitalistic system, we have to regenerate the social capital and regenerate the natural capital in order to be able to have a regenerative, renewing economic capital.
I want to give Art in Madison a chance to join in. Art, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, it sounds wonderful, Professor, but it seems that sustainable capitalism is an oxymoron because the entrenched elite interests in control, the ones that have just stolen trillions from our descendants in national debt and interest, these people are ruthless. They will sacrifice anything to stay in power and increase it. They will kill the planet. They will bomb people on any corner of the world, including here. So I think we're up against an enemy within, a shadow government that's giving away our children's future, and I say it's time to blow the bastards up. Thank you.
Well, I certainly don't disagree with your criticism of the way the situation is today, and I don't disagree with the magnitude of the task that's before us, because I think we've kind of come to accept the current situation as if it were inevitable. And I think the thing that we need to kind of start from is to recognize that the basic flaw is that we've allowed economics to kind of dictate every aspect of our life. We've allowed economics, the economic thinking, not only to permeate the economy itself, but we've allowed the economy to take priority over the good of society and to take priority over the future of humanity, which is tied back to our maintaining the integrity of the resources of the earth. And we need to start with the realization that the economy itself is inherently incapable of guiding us toward a sustainable society or a sustainable economy. And that's because all economic thinking, all economic value is inherently individualistic. There is no economic value in doing anything for the sole benefit of someone else. Now, there's a lot of things that we can do for other people that benefit us individually. That's the reason people hire people to work for them and invest in other people's businesses. But there's no economic value in doing anything solely for the benefit of someone else, and there's no economic value in doing anything for the benefit of society in general, rather than you as individuals. And also, because economic value is inherently individualistic, it's inherently short-term in nature. For example, there is no way of realizing any economic value from anything that happens after we're dead. It's simply impossible. And since life is inherently uncertain, we never know if we're going to be able to enjoy something even a week or a year from now as much as we do today. And so the economy places a large premium on the present relative to the future. For example, at an interest rate of 7%, which is the interest rates are simply the economy's way of reflecting its time preference, but an interest rate of 7%, if we have to wait or something 10 years in the future, it's only worth 50 cents on the dollar today, because if we had 50 cents today, we could invest it in a compound interest. It'd be worth a dollar 7 years from now. But where that comes around to, then, the economic system, economic value will not value the good of society as a whole, and it will not value anything for the benefit of those of future generations. And that's its inherent lack of reflecting any value for long-run sustainability. And as we go to an economy that increasingly is driven by the individual short-run economic self-interest, as ours increasingly is, we go toward a society that's inherently extractive and exploitive, a society that's degrading, that creates conflicts, that will take resources wherever you can get it, and it will exploit the resources of the earth. The place where we have to turn around is say, we're not the slaves of the economy. The economy's created for the benefit of people. We've allowed the economy to take control of us. We still have the ability as a society, as a people, to recreate an economy in the sense that would make it sustainable, that would make it socially just and ecologically sound. But we're going to have to take the initiative to take the power away from those that currently have the power and return it to the people that have a sense of social responsibility and have a sense of responsibility for the future of humanity.
Do you think the current administration is making an effort in the direction that you're proposing?
I think the current administration kind of realizes the problem. I'm not sure they realize the full magnitude problem, and they're trying to move in that direction. If you go back and read President Obama's inaugural address, there's a lot of real wisdom in that about what needs to be done, about the people taking control of the country again, the people returning to their basic core values of honesty, fairness, integrity, responsibility, respect, these sorts of things, and about the people ultimately having to force their government to do things. And those are the things that I'm talking about. But I think once you get an administration in Washington, the powers of keeping power where it is today, the power of keeping the focus of government on the economy rather than dealing with the broader social and ecological issues, which is basically the primary responsibility of government, is to deal with those non-economic issues. So there's strong forces that are pulling the administration back toward kind of the unsustainable philosophy of putting the economy first and really compromising on social and ecological issues. And I think it's up to the people of the country. I think we have a window of opportunity here, but it may be a fairly narrow window of opportunity, that if the people come forward and demand fundamental change, I think we have an administration that's willing to accommodate that. But if the people in general don't demand fundamental change, if we accept kind of the minor tinkering because we don't want to deal with the short run kind of uncomfortable situation of dealing with change, if we don't do our part, then I'm afraid the administration or any other administration will simply slip back into the old ways.
John Eichert, our guest today, Professor Emeritus of Agricultural Economics at the University of Missouri, Columbia, author of Sustainable Capitalism, A Matter of Common Sense, as published by Kamarian Press. You can join in with your questions or comments as we move along today at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Eichert, our guest, as we talk with him today about sustainable capitalism. He's the author of Sustainable Capitalism, A Matter of Common Sense, and also several books, A Return to Common Sense, Small Farms Are Real Farms, and Crisis and Opportunity, Sustainability in American Agriculture. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. And let's turn to Jeff in Madison next. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Interesting program. My outlook is that sustainable capitalism is an oxymoron, that the only proper vehicle for either prison or capitalist reform is a bulldozer.
Well, John, I don't know.
I get that response a lot, and I think it's probably deserved from the history of capitalism. I think if you look at the history of capitalism, you'd certainly have to question whether or not it's sustainable. And a lot of people coming from a socialist perspective think it's inherently heading in a direction of being exploiting and extractive because it's tied up in the need for inevitable growth. And if you take those assumptions, then I have no disagreement with it being an oxymoron. But if you take the broader perspective of capitalism that I mentioned before as looking at natural capital and social capital being the foundation for economic capitalism and see capitalism in that sense, then I would argue that there's no inherent need for growth in that kind of a system. I really don't care whether you call it sustainable capitalism or sustainable socialism or a sustainable theocracy. We can call it whatever we want. But for sustainability, we have to move the emphasis away from simply focusing on the narrow individual self-interest to looking more broadly at the interest of society and the interest of the future as reflected through the interest of the earth. And some people say, well, that's so idealistic and naive that nobody would ever do that. But I would argue that all we really have to do is kind of listen to our common sense again. That's where the common sense of capitalism comes from. If we think about it, we know that our overall well-being, our happiness of people, isn't just about our material economic well-being. That's what the economy is about. It's about our individual material well-being. And that's an important part because we're physical beings and we need to take care of those physical material needs. But our common sense tells us, again, if we'll simply stop and think, that we're also social beings, that we need relationships with other people, not because of what we'll get for ourselves, but simply because we need to relate. We need to have friends. We need to have families. We need to have those relationships in and of themselves. And if we have all of the money and material well-being in the world, but we don't have a friend, we don't have families, we don't have any relationships, then we know we'll be miserable. And what I'm talking about is valuing those relationships. That's what society is all about. It's valuing relationships and families and communities in and of themselves and balancing that with our physical well-being or our physical needs. And the third dimension of our well-being is we need some sense of purpose and meaning. And that goes beyond the material. It goes beyond the social. And that's where the ethical comes into our overall quality of life. And that's what sustainability is about. That's the only sense in which we feel any responsibility for people of future generations is an ethical or moral sense that that's part of our purpose for being a member of this human race, is to perpetuate the race and to try to make sure that we don't diminish the opportunities for those people to come in the future while we're meeting our individual material and social needs today. And so what I'm talking about is sustainable capitalism, is a capitalistic system that would continue to pursue a better life without having to continue to pursue material economic growth. It would simply be a society and an economy that realize the importance of balance and harmony between the physical and the social and the ethical, meaning the ecological, the economic, and the social. And it would be one that of balance and harmony where we'd have continual improvement in human well-being without requiring economic growth and without requiring ever-increasing resources and without requiring ever-increasing material benefits. You know, all of the studies that have been done on happiness and human well-being and quality of life over the last several decades, and there's more and more of them being done, indicate that, you know, the developed world, including the United States, we haven't really increased our overall happiness and well-being in the last 50 years, even though we've tremendously increased our physical and material wealth. So I think it's time to wake up and realize that we need to be moving in a different direction, and I think we can. It's a matter of returning to our common sense of what makes life right and what makes life good.
Andre in Wauwatosa asks, why would fiat capitalism as an economic process be worth sustaining? Aren't you talking about sustaining natural capital?
Right. Well, I think we're talking about sustaining natural capital, but we're also talking about sustaining social capital. And if we do that, then we can sustain the economic capital. And again, you know, I really don't care what we call it. We're talking about a sustainable economy and a sustainable society. I'm not tied up in the word capitalism other than the fact that I think capitalism, that kind of the market economy, is the most efficient way of dealing with those things that are purely individual in nature. And that includes a lot of what we're about. You know, in any situation where our individual actions don't have any negative impacts on society or negative impacts on the earth, there's no reason that we shouldn't be allowed to pursue those in a free market kind of system with people that are work harder or more effectively having more, because if one person has more but not at the expense of anyone else, there's nothing wrong with that. If one generation has more but it doesn't deplete or diminish the opportunities of the future, there's nothing wrong with that. So I think, you know, basically there's no better system that's ever been devised of meeting our individual material needs than that of a free market, truly free market capitalistic system, which is another story we don't really have today. But I don't think there's any better system of meeting those individual material needs that's been devised. We just simply can't expect the market economy or the capitalistic, traditional capitalistic part of it to do things that it's inherently incapable of doing, which is meeting the broader social needs of society and of meeting the needs of future generations.
Sure. Earl in Medford has a question or comment for you. Earl, hello.
Hello and good morning. Great topic.
Thank you.
Especially on a rainy morning. I wanted to talk about the scale of our efforts. I went back to a book that I had read in the early 1970s by E.F. Schumacher called Small is Beautiful, Economics as if People Mattered.
Right.
And I'm worried that we're only approaching these large global-type organizations with solutions, and we don't learn from the small towns and, like, small credit unions who seem to be doing very well. And all we say is that the huge global financial conglomerates are too big to fail. Will our efforts to get out of this focus too much on these large, humongous organizations, or can we learn from Small is Beautiful?
Well, I think we can certainly learn from Small is Beautiful, and I think that our efforts today are focused too narrowly on these large industrial, I would call them, operations. They become large as a consequence of focusing on kind of the short-run productivity. You end up with systems that are very efficient in extraction and exploitation, as I talked about, and the basic kind of strategies that they follow, I mentioned, was specialization, specialize in doing fewer things so you can do them better, then standardization, you have to standardize the parts and the function so that they fit together. And then you've simplified the overall operation to that point where you can consolidate into larger and larger units. And that's the reason we have the big operations today, is they're focusing on this narrow economic efficiency of specialization, standardization, which automatically leads you to larger and larger kind of operations. But as I said before, those are inherently, they gain their economic efficiency and their productivity through extraction and exploitation. When we change our way of thinking around to regeneration and renewal, then it takes us in a fundamentally different direction, because if we focus again on the model of living systems, then we see that living things that are healthy living systems or individuals accommodate themselves to their specific situation and their specific geographic location or climate or their specific communities or the specific cultural values of particular groups of people. And when we begin to focus on that, then we find that the things that are most efficient and most effective in meeting the broader ecological, social, and economic needs of people are not the large, specialized, standardized operations, but are the more diverse, kind of individualistic, site-specific, more dynamic kind of operations that we see in living systems. So I think if we change our thinking, there's a natural evolution toward smaller, more individualized, more more site-specific kinds of solutions to all of our problems. But I would want to be careful to point out here that these large operations that are in existence today are not going to give up their political or their economic power without a fight, because they're in a position to continue to extract resources from the earth and society. And until we take that power away, we're not going to be able to naturally evolve toward a different kind of system.
Yeah. We're, if you think about this small being good in many ways, as small as beautiful, as Earl was saying, we're actually experiencing, I think, in America, a small farm revolution to some extent. I mean, we have many, many large farms online today, but I think we're also seeing a regrowth of small farms.
Yes, I would agree with that. And, I wrote the book Small Farms Are Real Farms, and that's basically a series of articles that I wrote over years, but the whole underlying concept of that is that farms aren't just about maximizing productivity or economic efficiencies, that farms really historically, and still I would argue real farms, are about the quality of life of the farmers and the people that live in rural communities, and farms are really about stewardship of the soil and caretakers of the land and passing the land on from generation to generation as productive as it was before. And I think that's that philosophy that I'm talking about of real farms and small farms is one that's certainly growing. I spend a good bit of my time since retirement speaking and writing and speaking, doing other things. But a lot of the places that I go are what I call sustainable agriculture groups. And there's an increasing number of farmers that are farming in different ways. They're farming in more sustainable ways. They're balancing taking care of the land and care for the community and the family with the economic, and they tend to be identified with labels such as organic or holistic or ecological or biological or innovative or practical or various other names. But what sets them apart from the conventional kind of, I call, industrial farming operations is this focus on balance and harmony, working in harmony with nature, working in harmony with the community. And there's at least six conferences now across the country that are held on an annual basis that draw over 1,500 people a year. And the big conferences is relatively few agency people or university people. These are farmers. In fact, the Upper Midwest Organic Growers Conference, I understand, was held in, I think it was in La Crosse, Wisconsin, last winter, and it drew, I think, over 2,500 people this year. I know they were getting close to 2,500 people. So there's a whole segment of agriculture that's rising out here, that's emerging from organic foods and local foods and low input and things of this nature. There's just a whole new kind of food movement and a new farm movement that's taking place. It's still relatively small compared to what I call kind of the industrial agriculture, but it's certainly growing and it's certainly viable out here. And I think it's a reflection of the awakening of people within this society that there's something fundamentally wrong. Not just in our economy in general, but in agriculture and all of the individual components of our economy and society as well.
Steele in Neenah, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, at the UN General Assembly, the Bolivian president initiated International Day of Mother Earth. And it's kind of a nice thing. And one of the comments he said is how we've come from the capitalist conception and that we've been held hostages for centuries. And accordingly, the earth was seen as a mere instrument of production without purpose, a reservoir to be exploited at our pleasure. And, well, it's nice that, you know, we have another day that maybe, you know, too bad we always leave it to the school children, but we can think of, you know, how we get along with what we're up to. And one book that caught me years ago, and I still think about it a lot, is called Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, where he sort of had a nationalized system of labor and commerce and, you know, not big inequities between high workers and low workers. Anyway. That's my comment.
All right. Thank you for calling. John, comment from you?
Well, I think that this is the United Nations, and globally there's probably more consciousness even than there is in this country about the real need to reconnect with the earth. That's what the earth movement is about, the global environmental movement, and the social justice movement is equally important, because when you talk about social justice, then we're talking about maintaining the productivity, not just the humaneness of the social system, but also the productivity of that system is tied in with, you know, being kind and compassionate to people is, you know, it's important to us socially, but it's also important to us economically. And I think those things are critically important as we look to the future. And we need to realize, and I think there's growing realization here, that economic disparity within a society is very degrading of the social fabric of that society, and becomes degrading to the economic survivability, because you're degrading that social capital when you do that. And we certainly allowed that to happen in this country. The disparity between the rich and the poor, or rich and the rest of us, we might say, in this country is wider than it has been at any time since the Gilded Age of the early 1900s, which was prior to the Great Depression, which I think is no coincidence as we look at it here. And this isn't just a liberal sort of thing here, because the up top 1% of the people in this country today, at least before the financial meltdown, the top 1% of people with the highest income had more annual income than the bottom one half within our society. And even Alan Greenspan, who's hardly a flaming liberal, you know, past chairman of the Federal Reserve System, said that the gap between the rich and the rest of us is growing so wide and so fast that it eventually could threaten the very stability of our democratic capitalistic society. So I hope there's a growing realization that social justice, social equity is just as important as environmental integrity and resource conservation and resource renewal. Both of those things are critically important if we're going to have a sustainable society and a sustainable economy.
Let's go to Matthew in Warren, Illinois next. Matthew, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I'm wondering, how do these large-scale industrial farms that are rapidly coming into both Northwest Illinois, where I'm at, and Wisconsin, work in this model? And you know, since they force out what I would consider your sustainable family farms, and they, in a way, change forever the landscape, and along the same lines, how do we get our politicians to stop promoting these, which in the end, I feel, destroy the community and the soil?
I agree with what you're saying. I think it's very hard for me to see how the large industrial kind of operations do, in fact, fit in. I don't think there's any way to kind of tinker with them to make them ecologically sound and socially responsible when you get to a certain size. And you're just working in conflict with society and in conflict with nature to the point where I think it's almost impossible to develop technologies that will mitigate or offset all of the ecological and social damages that are done. Still, I want to keep an open mind and say, okay, sustainability is about ecological integrity, social responsibility, economic viability. I simply don't think that the large industrial farming operations, either the big confinement animal feeding operations or the large crop operations with genetically modified crops and things of that nature fit into that. Okay, the question then, how do we get people to change? Again, we have to take control of our government. I think we have to start at the local level, and that's because the agribusiness corporations have so much power at the state and federal level, it's almost impossible to get, you know, legislation through that really addresses the issue of agriculture sustainability. But at the local level, I think people still have a basic fundamental right of self-determination and self-defense. And I think the real vulnerability of the large operations, particularly the large livestock operations, but to a certain extent the others, is that they're a legitimate threat to public health. And there's an increasing number of credible scientific studies from major medical and scientific institutions that are documenting the very specific health risks that are associated with agricultural pesticides and over-fertilization and with the large-scale confinement animal feeding operations, particularly in antibiotic resistance and various other places. And I think local people is where we're going to start reclaiming democracy, and one of the places to reclaim that democracy is for local people to stand up and say, we have a right to determine when our health is threatened based on credible information, and we have a right to self-defense. And thus far, the courts have upheld the right of local people whenever they could legitimately document a public health risk of even going in and flying in the face of economic commerce or interstate commerce laws if it's necessary for protection of public health. But it's up to the people to take control of their country and to take control of their own communities.
And on that note, we have to close. John, it's been a real pleasure. I hope we'll have a chance to talk again on the program.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it, and I appreciate all the callers calling in. I think you had some excellent comments and questions.
Thank you, John. John Eichert is a professor emeritus of agricultural economics at the University of Missouri-Columbia and is the author of many books, including Sustainable Capitalism, A Matter of Common Sense. It's published by Cimmerian Press. He's also author of Return to Common Sense, Small Farms Are Real Farms, and also Crisis and Opportunity, Sustainability in American Agriculture. Let's see if we can have him back and do this again. Well, one of the things I think, or one of the great things about our communities and our rural communities in Wisconsin have been our small farms. Part of those small farms, or farms just in general, are its barns. And there's a great new book out called Wisconsin Barns that we're going to be talking about next. They're Wisconsin's icons, aren't they? Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.